The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Mark coins the phrase and I steal it for years. Joe talks divergence, IoT, OT, IT divergence. ELN starts a new thing, more fraud, spies, and lies from the war front, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. For more details, become a member at enterprisemindset.com.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. X marks the spot, or rather no spots. Company after company after company is removing or suspending advertising on X, formerly Twitter. Apparently, Musk has been showing his anti-Semitism more blatantly than usual, and the big corporates have finally had enough, for now. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show.
According to the San Francisco Chronicle, cell phone users around the country have for months reported a growing barrage of puzzling text messages from people who appear to have the wrong number.
Okay, those of you that have been listening to the show know the rest of the story, but let's just go through it again.
A text might read,
Hey, what are you doing Monday?
Or,
I have something to tell you.
The message could be even simpler.
I'm bored.
Or,
hello.
First thing, you get a text message from somebody, yep, it's probably a spam. You don't know it is.
Many people have been conditioned to understand such messages as opening salvos in complicated cons. Just as they have with phone calls purporting to be from the IRS or emails regarding wealthy heirs stuck in overseas prisons. Yet the texts continue. That's because, authorities say, victims keep falling for this particular scheme, which combines aspects of romance and investment scams and is known as pig butchering, because marks are fattened up before the kill. When they fall for it, the haul can be massive. Documents filed this week by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco during International Fraud Awareness Week show how the scam works. They describe how a 68-year-old Santa Clara man, who had recently divorced and was struggling through financial problems, received a text message in February from a number he didn't recognize. When he responded, the stranger said her name was Janie Lee.
Then they start into the romance thing, okay? Just to be clear, when you're an older gentleman, recently divorced, young, beautiful ladies do not really want to get involved with you. That's just a scam. It's a trap.
That she was a Houston clothing designer, and that she had the wrong number. The trap had been set, and Lee kept the conversation going via text.
Let's see what's next.
Before moving it to more secure channels, WhatsApp and Telegram.
Ding, 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 ding. WhatsApp, Telegram, not secure channels. Scammer havens. People move it there to get it out of the other forum so they don't get tracked. It's a scam.
RB and Lee discussed personal information, their backgrounds, relationship statuses, businesses, and finances.
Personal information. Okay, oh, how are you doing? Where do you live? How much money do you have? Blah, 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 blah. Anything and everything about your personal life so that we can get you to say you're in love with us or you like us or whatever.
Within weeks, this budding relationship became romantic in nature, with Lee repeatedly messaging RB about their future together. Before long, Lee got to work. She, or perhaps he, shifted the conversation to her success in trading cryptocurrency.
Okay, oh boy, I'm brilliant at, cryptocurrency. Okay, you know, the bells should be ringing loud and clear. You know, the alarm bells.
By March, she had convinced RB to invest.
You know, don't put money into cryptocurrency, especially in somebody else's account. Cryptocurrency scams are, well, most cryptocurrency that we see is actually scams or frauds or these sorts of things historically. So,
helping him to create an account on the well-known trading platform Crypto.com, where he bought digital currency and sent it to Extra, which appeared to be another legitimate crypto exchange.
And then, let's put it in the popular platform and then move it to my account, Extra. Give me a break.
Following the initial investment, RB was able to view his fictitious earnings on the Extra website.
So again, anytime you're using anything other than the widely known, widely published stuff, it's even more risky, which is not to say that the widely known, widely published crypto scam stuff isn't risky.
Which reported a 20% to 30% gain against his initial investment.
And then, of course, you know, you view your fictitious earnings, 20% within days or weeks or months. No, I'm sorry. That market is extremely volatile. But if that's what you're seeing, then you should know you're being ripped off then.
By April 22nd, RB had invested $260,000 through 8 deposits.
You know, 8 deposits coming to $260,000, that's a lot each deposit. Well, okay, diversify your risk. That is, you know, risk is the uncertainty about the future. So you should diversify that uncertainty into different sorts of pools of money. Don't put them all in the same place, obviously. Not so obvious to this person.
At that point, his account showed a value of $487,000, an 87% bonanza in a matter of weeks. 3 days later, the divorcee tried to withdraw $100,000.
So just as a rule of thumb, everything you hear here is stuff we talked about all the time. It's too good to be true is sort of a good category for the whole thing.
Instead of receiving his withdrawal, RB received a message from Extra Customer Service saying that by May 2, 2023, in order to verify his account, RB needed to send his Extra account an additional amount worth approximately 20% of his account balance.
So, you know, don't get caught, but look, here's another question. What do? Well, you call the FBI.
Fearing he'd been taken, RB called the FBI, but there was only so much investigators could do at that point.
That's the right thing to do, but, you know, they probably can't help you that much.
Agents raced to try to find the money.
Now, they're currently in court on this, trying to recover money from lots of these scams, and But the chances are you're not going to get it. I mean, last year, $2.57 billion in reported losses from crypto scams. That's just crypto scams, not to mention all the other similar scams. This used to be called a long con, but these days they've changed their verbiage. So this so-called pig butchering, that's what they call it, because they consider you to be the pig that they're bringing to the slaughter. So in any case, you know, you should know better, but if you didn't know better before, you know better now. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
We're back with Mark Menz. And so I want to go into, you know, sort of the other side of being a forensics person, somebody working, you know, within the bounds of the legal system to provide expert testimony on matters of evidence that are associated with, in this case, digital systems, right? And my question is, how do you sell it to people? And I want to start by expressing my deep gratitude for your teaching me how to sell this. And I think you remember, yes, you do. I can see by the smile on your face. And of course, we're on radio, so they can't see it. But we were at a conference down in Monterey, and I had a table there, and you came over and you gave me the biggest hint of my career in how to sell digital forensics. And here it is. It's high fees, no guarantees.
Yep.
Okay. Now, but it turns out that's not my closer, right? That's the opening of the sale. The closer is, we won't quit till you run out of money.
I remember that too. That's true. That is a good closer. That's a good closer.
And so let's, just for clarity to help our audience, why is it that that is in fact actually a good way to sell that service?
You don't want to have someone who does not have the knowledge and experience doing your work because they just happen to be inexpensive. There are a lot of button pushing people out there, as we call them, but people who really don't have a deep understanding or good understanding of how the systems work or how this evidence system forensics work. These people, you know, I took a class, so now I'm a forensic person because I can click a button and I get deleted files. You want someone more than that because you get what you pay for. And a quality person is not going to be inexpensive. They may not be worth super money. Some are, depending on the case. But you want to get somebody who has the training and experience.
I explain it a different way. My description of it is, you know, high fees, no guarantees. What does that mean about your customer, right? It means they're desperate.
Right.
Because otherwise, would you pay a lot of money, you know, without a guarantee? Well, because I need somebody who actually knows enough to help me, right?
Right.
And we won't quit till you run out of money. That's a lot, sort of more of the same thing. But I think the real point is that our customer is not the person who's in the case. It's not the client. Our customer is the lawyer.
Right.
And the lawyer recognizes that their business model is exactly that. Right.
That's true.
Yeah. Because there's no guarantee. If you go into litigation, you know, most lawyers tell me it's a flip of the coin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you don't know what the jury's going
to
do. You know, so you're flipping the coin one way or the other, which does not give me the confidence in our legal system that I should have. But then my experience in the legal system is justice is very often served. In the cases I've been in, you know, the result has been what I believe to be the right result.
I have not, I have to agree with you with mine as well. most of my cases, I can think of maybe one, but all of them, the other 99,000 of them, whatever, justice was served. May not be perfect justice, but it was served.
And the truth comes out through this adversarial system.
Correct. It does. Yeah.
Again, astonishing to me that you actually get at the truth by having people on opposite sides who are sincerely trying their best to put that point of view in there.
Yep.
But in the context of the admissibility requirements, right?
Right.
More probative than prejudicial. You can't just come up with BS and, prohibitions against, just repeating what somebody else said, hearsay evidence, and so forth.
Right.
So I find it astonishingly good at that. So what do you think, Chris? Actual true believers in the legal system?
Well, right. I mean, and again, policy and hacking is one of my favorite things right now. If you have to look at the environment, right? If you're in a lawless environment, then there's not a lot of policy, right? And if you're a lawful environment, then the policy is the law. And you look at how it is executed and how it is worked out. And even, let's just say poorly organized legal environment, you can navigate, you can figure out. And frankly, I agree, an adversarial system with an arguably impartial judge and jury works quite well, right? You may not get the result you expect, but if someone has a better solution, I'd like to hear it. Argue. You got to argue.
Right. I think the fundamental here is it's the worst system devised except all the others, right?
Exactly. Right. Some of the war stories I have in my life as a young man in the 80s in South Carolina, I was up in front of judges twice. And what it taught me is judges are awesome. They shut me down. Right.
Rightfully so. Right.
Yes.
But I think that's fair, right? Part of the whole issue here, sort of the system of justice is you get so many people that don't believe in it, so many people that think that lawyers are just, I don't know what the right word for it is, corrupt, so-and-sos. And apparently there are a few of those occasionally, like anything else. But there's ethical standards for lawyers, and they follow them for the most part. And the judges enforce them. And, again, it's all imperfect. I don't want to get into politics, but there are a lot of high-profile legal cases today. In these very high-profile cases, you see, sort of extraordinary extremes of behaviors of plaintiffs, defendants, and so forth. And the judges seem to just be steady.
I happened today to listen live, to a case that's sort of in the news with a lawyer, who's pled guilty to some charges, and listening to the judge, as you say, steadily just read through. It's like, before you, I accept your guilty plea. We need to say out loud in front of each other, do you understand what this implies? And it took a while. I was doing other things. I just let it play. And there's like clause after clause. If do you understand, have you and your lawyer gone through the fact that I accept the guilty plea, that means these implications for you. And it didn't leave anything out. It's just a long process where you say out loud what you're agreeing to before you agree to it. That to me always, rings of hopefulness in resolving things.
Right. And it's in open court, or at least it's a recording, but, in federal court. But the notion somehow that it's unfair or that nobody knows or it's cheating or behind the scenes, that's just not right. It's just not how it is, right? It's the reality is sitting right in front of your face. And so I do the same thing in my contracts. This is one of the things I really love about that system where they just walk through it with you, make sure you understand. Yes, you say that, I say that, we all agree. In open court, everybody can listen. There's a recording. The stenographer is taking, the court reporter is taking a report on it. There's every reason to believe that you meant it, we meant it. There's no impediment in your ability to understand. We made sure that that was okay, right? Well, I do the same thing on contracts, right? I insist that we read through them. And both of us, or however many of us, on a live online remote, and I read through every line, make sure they understand and answer any questions they have. I tell them I'm not a lawyer. This is my understanding of it. You should get a lawyer and check it out if you have any questions about it. And then even after doing that, I sort of require that they don't sign it today. You know, so, you know, think about it overnight, take as long as you want, and then we're going to sign it because this is a serious thing. I'm committing to 6 months or a year or 2 years of my time and effort and my resources. I want to make sure that you understand and you're serious about it. You know, and so, no, that's not true with every online button I click. But when I have a, you know, a contract between my corporation and one of my companies and some other entity about what we're going to do, I just want to make real sure that we're clear, that it's not, oh, you said this. And I've had cases where lawyers have come at me on behalf of other people saying, well, they didn't understand this. You know, it's all this small font on a little screen and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, no. You know, we had it on the screen. We blew it up to whatever size you needed to read it. You said you could read it. We walked through it. Every question, every answer, I explained to a lawyer, and I do it every time. So if you claim I didn't do it, you know, I don't have proof of it. I don't have a recording. I do have the phone call, the you know, calendar entry of the thing where we did the review of the contract, and the actual date of signing of the contract was the next day or whatever. And you know, that was a 1 hour call where we went through these things, and I do that every time. So that's sufficient. Oh, and contemporaneous notes that I keep, that's probably sufficient to indicate, oh, I don't remember you ever telling me that. No, we went through every line. I do it every time. So I just think that sort of approach that the courts take of being thorough. Now, it gets me into trouble, right? And part of the trouble it gets me into is my first interactions with, for example, you.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you remember this, but what's the first agreement we ever signed?
Oh, probably some consulting thing. Probably even before Fearless.
My recollection is, and maybe it wasn't you. I mean, I've had this a couple of times. But my recollection is that the first time it was like, God, all this contract stuff, all this word stuff. You know, why am I going through all this word salad? You know,
I hope it wasn't me because I like to believe that I always like that sort of thing, right? You know, so I say this, you know, there's a great deal of cynicism around about, you know, the system we live in and everything else. You know, listen to George Carlin after he turned 50, right? You know,
but he was still hilarious. Let's be clear.
He's a funny guy, but yes. But, you know, my advice to people on the civic side is, in your life, at some point, go to a city hall meeting. You know, maybe you have an issue, but, you know, sit through it anyways. You know, just sort of watch and see how it works. You know, in corporate governance, the same sort of thing, right? You know, and you should look around to see if you're allowed. I mean, can I go? Or is it, you know, it transparent systems are fairly obvious, right? You should see the manhole covers. You should be able to, you know, open the access panels and climb inside. If there's no access panels, then maybe you have an issue. But the system we're embedded in, this general, you know, global system we're embedded in, has a lot of transparency, right? And the U.S., you know, is actually pretty bloody good at this in the public and private sectors.
Well, here's a really good example of that. And so, again, not in the politics of it, but in the recent events where, you know, the Israelis, well, let's start with facts, right? There was a hospital in Gaza Strip where some sort of a munition exploded apparently in the parking lot and caused some number of deaths. And I don't want to go into numbers because there's disagreements about that. I think everybody agrees with what I just said. Let's be clear on that. So immediately thereafter, I'm talking about within an hour for sure, maybe within minutes, I guess it was Hamas and Hezbollah and other similar entities claimed that Israel bombed the hospital. Okay, instantly. Now, you know, I thought that Israel should have responded very quickly, saying, you know, we haven't finished checking it all out, but you know, we've checked this far and we know that these folks on our side didn't do it, and blah, 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 blah. Because, you know, the lie gets around the world, you know, what is it? Yeah, a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth gets its hands on.
Yeah, right. You know,
but more to the point, remember, halfway around the world going in both directions means it gets everywhere. Okay. So now you have protests on the street and so forth. Okay. So their process, and on the media, they were asked, you know, well, what's your evidence of this? And they didn't provide any information or evidence. They just said, you know, bad Israel did it, right? They hate us. Sorry. And they may hate them. I don't know. So Israel, followed by the United States, came out with statements that were fairly authoritative that said, well, look, here's the evidence we have. First of all, there's a news station that's not a big fan of the administration in Israel. And here's their video of it recorded live that they put on the air almost immediately. So there's no ability or time frame at this point in time to create the fake of that in the amount of time available. All right, so that's it. The missile didn't come from here. It wasn't shot out of a plane. It was ground to ground from somewhere fairly near there. Okay, that's thing one. Then they had pictures of the crater. Now, the crater is not on the hospital. The crater is in a parking lot. And the crater is about, you know, 4 or 5 cars long. You know, it's a circle about that size. So it didn't actually hit the hospital. Okay. So now the other thing about the crater is the Israelis claim, well, look, here's pictures of craters caused by the missiles from this group. And they're all about the same size, same shape, same characteristics. Here's craters caused by the things we shoot. You know, they're much bigger. I mean, way, way bigger. Lots more damage. Okay. We didn't do it. And then the other thing is they played a recording of some group within either, you know, whatever it was, whatever the group was, internal communication saying, you know, basically, I think we had a misfire and it was us that did it. But of course, they won't admit that. So whether that's a true or a false recording. All right. So there's that plus whatever other sensors. There got to be gobs of sensors in that area. So it looks like the fact of it is that Israel did not do that. Okay. Well, everybody says we don't believe any of that BS. We have to have a commission, whatever, because the politicians can't agree to it because the Arab street, as they call it, has, you know, hundreds of thousands of people protesting, trying to set things on fire, screaming they hate, you know, Israel and Israel's the cause. And all this influence operation that's going on. Okay, now that's part one. Here's part two. A couple days later, maybe a week later, just a couple days later, Israel launched a missile that they say was aimed at a Hamas group that was across the street from a church. And they destroyed the place. And what they said was that ancillary damage from hitting that place, which was right across the street from a church, did some damage to the church. They took responsibility for it. Now, that transparency, that little piece of transparency, and any other transparency like that, that's the demonstration that you didn't do the other thing. So if all the time you're saying, yes, we did it, when it was bad or when it was good, you say, yes, we did it, that transparency makes the big difference between the credibility that you have tomorrow and the credibility of the other side, which doesn't tell you anything. It lies about everything. And that's why it's believable what the IDF is saying about both of these things and many other things. And it's not as credible what Hamas and Hezbollah and whatever the other groups are that are saying. So that's transparency in action. Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
I don't know. I had a thought in my mind earlier, but I think I've lost it. But the again, you know, I argue this all the time, right? You know, in business, right? You know, that transparency, in fact, I've done more than 4 dozen podcasts in the last 2 years for Cybeats on the topic of transparency. So when things happen, they happen, right? And it's not even a matter of good or bad. I think that actually does matter. I think that's why it ends up being better, faster, cheaper. But, you know, an honest system just doesn't have as much resistance, doesn't have as much grit in the gears. I'm searching for an analogy here that doesn't have to do with boats in the water, because you just want to have efficient systems, right? And it's, yeah, we all rightly complain about the public sector, right? You know, it's a different world than out here in the capitalist, you know, private sector, trying to, you know, feed yourself and everything else. However, right, how do you have systems where people in power in the public sector can't show favoritism towards, you know, their brother-in-law? You introduce process that slows it down and costs money and makes it complicated. You know, the alternative is a really simple system where yeah, everything is corrupt because there's no checks and balances.
Well, it's so not necessarily corrupt. It's not necessarily corrupt. The problem in most government, though, is they keep adding more stuff to fight against corruption, and it gets to the point where the stuff that fights against corruption is, you know, more damaging than any corruption that you could have experienced.
Well, yeah, you know, this is the Cyber Show. Let's see if we can help bend this, you know, towards the purpose, because policy guides everything, right? You know, business, the systems we build, the standards open, you know, and so on and so forth. And one of the true things about these any complex mechanism, physical or otherwise, we create, is that after a while, you build the first mechanism to solve the problem. But after a while, you start serving the mechanism. And they can grow bloated and out of control when you know, perhaps it's time to build a new one. I think that happens in civil society and laws and policy a great deal. And it's something we could probably be a whole lot better at. But I also think that we're getting to the point where we actually can. I think, you know, the massive language models and so forth out there, this AI, you know, that everybody's talking about, is the kind of thing we need. You know, it's like having 1,000 interns to read through all of the laws and connect all of the dots and illustrate, you know, perhaps to this example, what pieces are so complicated and convoluted, you know, structures of multiple things that could be replaced by something else.
Yeah, well, so there are a couple of issues. Obviously, it has to get better at it, and I suspect it will. Because, I mean, I think it's mostly right brain. It's just, but it's spewing forth stuff without checking consistency, without checking logical rationality and any of that stuff, which tends to be the so-called left brain. So I think that those problems, people are addressing them, trying to address them. They haven't gotten them there yet. But I think there's a lot of efficiency to be gained. And, you know, I embrace efficiency. When the first thing with this came out, like, you know, late last year, early this year, you know, I said it's like the calculator. And I'll hold true to that, right? It's like the calculator. It's a tool. It's going to be used because it's better than, it gets right answers more quickly and more correctly than trying to do it by hand, right? And it consistently does that. And it's not true that calculators are perfect. They are not perfect. Right. But on the other hand, you know, I think they're probably better than I am at arithmetic.
Pencils aren't perfect either. Right. You know, when you look at the way we do, you know, look at the way we execute, you know, or process the legal system right now by hand. And what does that smell like to you? I mean, that smells like the kind of things we've done in information systems, you know, consistently decade to decade. But you crawl inside a system, you look at how the information is being processed in a legal world. You have people literally just reading and reading and reading and taking notes and saying, oh, all right, you know, this clause inside this policy connects to or applies to this, what I'm researching now. Because nobody knows. It's too much. It's unmapped. And it's exactly the kind of things that large language models are you know, going towards. You know, can I just say what policy applies to this and have it all laid out without having, you know, interns, you know, processing documents with their eyes.
Yeah, not anytime soon, but yeah, eventually. The question of when, if you think it's inevitable. The other side of it is, you know, I'm not sure I want that computer to make that determination because the humanity of the judge, the humanity of the jury, looks at the circumstance and says, yeah, technically, yeah, you're guilty, but I got to tell you, if I was in that situation, I'd do the same thing. So I'm just going to say, yeah, it may be against the law, but to heck with that. You know, you were trying to save your child, so you stole a piece of bread. Okay, great. You shouldn't go to jail for stealing the piece of bread. The society should have fed your child. The person who accused you of stealing it should have been willing to give you credit so you could feed your family. You know, they weren't dying of starvation too, or, you know, the circumstance justified.
Well, I'll argue, you know, both for the sake of taking the side, and actually I think this is true, that it won't remove the humanity. It'll kind of restore it, right? It's not a matter of making the judgment. It's just saying which pieces of policy touch on this, what applies, how is it, you know, where is the space of related code? And it's kind of like, you know, again, in the supply chain, in the software bill of material world, you know, the basic question is, you know, where do we put the code? And nobody knows. And you can find out, but it's a lot of work, so we're making that easier. In the same way, you know, where do we put the laws? Nobody knows.
We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show, so don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, KMBY, 1240 a.m., and on the web at thecybershow.co.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
We're having discussions with Joe Weiss. Joe is an old school control systems guy who worked on control systems for the first half of his career and ended up in cybersecurity by accident, as usual.
Welcome back, Joe. We were talking about, you know, the evolution of how the digital interface with the analog continuous world in the control systems arena ended up getting all fused together and how you were in the middle of it getting crushed by the politics along the way, of course, which is natural. Yeah. So even though you didn't know it was natural when you found yourself in it.
Right.
But let's talk about, you've done, I think, one of the most comprehensive reviews and studies of actual incidents involving harm to real people and financial loss associated with operational technology and associated with the, we'll call it the digital world that had, you know, interacted with it. Could you spend a few minutes where now you have this probably the best database anywhere and an ongoing collection of cyber-related incidents affecting control systems, especially where it's causing substantial loss of life or harm to humans or financial loss. Could you just talk a little bit about, you know, what that database is, where people can find it, and what kind of things, you know, you're finding out and telling people about that the world seems to just be unaware of?
Okay. Let me start out with trying to explain what is a control system cyber incident? And in a sense, how is it different than what IT looks at as a cyber event? Because that'll give you an idea of what I'm trying to collect and why. Okay. To IT, you're connected to the internet, you're running Windows, and somebody is trying to steal or manipulate your data. Okay. I think most people would agree that's what it is.
Well, it's interesting you say steal and manipulate. Because most people in cybersecurity historically, you know, they talk about CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability.
Yes.
And more importantly, they're always focused on leakage of secrets, right? And
yes.
Privacy and so forth.
Yes.
You always hear these major break-in at the Pentagon, blah, blah, blah. No classified information was leaked. And they don't mention the fact that their whole supply and logistics chain was disabled. Because, yes. You know, no classified information was leaked. So really, in the operational technology space, it's completely different. Leaking the information is almost never important relative to keeping the lights on or preventing people from being harmed.
Correct. In fact, so let me go to the next. NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technologies, had a definition of a cyber incident. And GAO, Government Accountability Office, has a similar one, as does ISA, International Society of Automation. And what it is electronic communication between systems or systems and people. In other words, your displays, okay, that affects or potentially can affect confidentiality, which is your C, integrity, which is your I, and availability, which is your A, okay? And it deliberately does not say it has to be malicious, okay? Now, the other point that's there, a couple of points about this. From our world, the most important letter isn't even there, which is the letter S for safety. The second thing is that even I or A are, the terms may be okay, but what and how they're applied aren't. So for IT, I and A are the integrity or availability of data. In our world, I is, for example, the integrity of the sensor measurement. A is the availability of the process. If you, like with a San Bruno natural gas pipeline rupture, when that pipeline ruptured, you no longer had availability of the pipe.
Yeah, so let's help with that, because in the information arena that this came from, I talk about it as assuring the utility of content. And very few other people historically have talked about it as assuring the utility of content. They're talking about other things. For me, it's the utility. And so in the wider area of cyber writ large, which includes control systems and so forth, I talk about assuring the utility of the mechanism, right? So the point here is that whatever the use is, the utility of the thing, that's what we're trying to make certain of. That's what we're assuring.
Correct.
And so if the utility includes safety, then that should be included in what we talk about. If the utility includes, you know, I need my bank to work right, it's about the function. It has nothing to do with the bits being right. Who cares if this bit changes from a 0 to a 1, right?
That's exactly the point. And this is where the difference lies. And this is part of where the culture is, because in the control system world, which you mentioned earlier, confidentiality, where is it really important for the control system world? It's really important where you have meters, okay? Your home meter or a business meter type of thing, you know, there's some confidentiality there. But quote unquote control systems writ large, confidentiality is really a minor consequence. Who cares if you can see this sensor signal now? That sensor signal is no longer valid.
Well, right. So there's that issue of timeliness. There's some other issues there. So there are cases where the confidentiality of sensor information is very important, but they're not as you normally think of. Yeah. I'll give you an example. In a classified environment where we did a study once, there were problems associated with the leakage of the parameters of a process. The parameters of that process would allow an enemy to be able to reproduce a capability that we had that other people did not have.
Right.
So in that case, those parameters, those specific parameters, you know, what temperature this thing is done at and how it's controlled, that had to be kept confidential. And so there are those cases. However, of the probably 100,000 parameters in this particular plant, there were probably 100 that would be in that realm. Whereas whatever they were making would not work if any of those other, you know, 99,900 or so were wrong. So assuring that the things are working right, that the set points are right, that the safety limits are set at the right level, that the pressure is being properly measured so that when you try to control it, you're doing the right control outputs. Otherwise, you'll cause the plant to blow itself up like what happened in Iran, apparently, right? So yeah, it's not confidentiality. And moment-to-moment information is almost never important to keep confidential.
So the entire concept of control system cyber, and I use the term control system because I also want to give you my difference between the words control systems and IT, OT, operational technology, because they're very different. Okay.
They are, well, it's sort of, they're, OT involves control systems, but
well,
not
true. Okay. What happened was...
Hang on, Joe. Name me an operational technology environment that doesn't have control systems.
The point is the operational technology environment. Let me before I give you an answer, I'm going to give you a different response. Just bear with me.
Naturally.
I have...
None of you so far answered any of my questions directly.
Anyways, a friend of mine... was a substation manager for maybe about 20 years. Okay. Very, very, very good. Very, very knowledgeable. Power systems engineer. And I was on a call with him, and it was one of these grid, protect the grid type phone calls. And I put him on the spot because I didn't ask him this before, but I asked him in front of everybody, do you consider yourself to be OT? You know what his response was? No. OT was a term coined by Gartner because Gartner didn't know what a control system was.
Yeah, so you like industrial control systems instead?
So what they did is they simply said, if you're not IT, you're OT. A pump, a valve, a turbine, a transformer, a relay, none of those are OT. None, zero. OT are people or networks, okay?
I'm sorry, according to who?
Well, the point being that OT is a term that many, 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 I might as well say most people in the security world know. But if you go to an engineering conference and you start talking OT, in many cases, people will have no idea what the hell you're talking about. Pardon my French. You know, what you're talking about.
Okay? Oh, they're talking about distributed control systems and SCADA systems and industrial
systems. Yes, and pumps and valves.
And controllers, yeah.
But the point is, OT aren't in that discussion, okay?
Fair enough. But nonetheless, you know, we have a tendency to use new terminology. And I think operational technology is a good term for this stuff. There's also IoT, which is Internet of Things, which is this other, you know, crazy thing usually thought of as the small version of OT, the stuff that isn't for big, you know, plants and so forth. But I will agree to, you know, your view of different perspectives on the use of those words. That's all fine. But operational technology is increasingly being used to mean that larger thing.
Except here's the thing, too. When you look at regulations coming down from Washington or,
I try not to look at them.
I know. No, I'm just saying, or laws being promulgated, whatever. When it comes to cyber, they're almost all of them have an IT focus or genesis. You don't see anything dealing with serial networks. You don't see anything dealing with sensors.
I see them. Yeah, my world is a fusion of all these different worlds.
But I'm just saying.
Yours is too, Joe. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you started out in control systems.
That's right.
And now you're, you know, in this enormously crazier space, right? The control system space is a space from engineering, right? Yes. Where people do calculations and have physical properties, right? And these sorts of, and the IT space is the place where, well, we'll just make the computer run faster. And if, as long as it's fast enough, it'll still work, even though it doesn't, you know, it's not true, but that doesn't matter to them. And the IT space is the, anybody with no degree from anywhere can all of a sudden, with no knowledge, build a new application that becomes popular and you run the world.
Yes.
And the operational technology has, you know, is a space where, you know, where people die and things blow up. And reconciling those two is problematic.
It's really, really, really difficult because I live in Silicon Valley, where everything is about what is the latest and greatest. And if I can increase speed by even 1%, everybody's going to buy. Well, in my world, until it's tested, you know, extensively, it's not coming right off the drawing board.
Well, but Joe, it's not just that. I mean, let's talk about changes, right? Let's talk about patching. So people want to patch my manufacturing line by sending down an update to some piece of software. No, my answer is no, no, no.
Well,
because every time you patch something, you break something else. And the cost and the consequences of some software change that they, you know, they thought was simple and easy. The other one is internet connectivity, right? Well, why should it be that my real-time control system should depend on some key that's in a cryptographic key system that's sitting somewhere else in the world? Because if that outage happens when that control system has to respond within a millisecond and it doesn't have the key, that thing's going to break. Something's going to blow up. Something's going to get destroyed. Bad things are going to happen. They don't understand this concept of separation because they want everything unified.
Let me bring one thing or a couple of things to what you just said.
You guys agreed.
Yeah, well, I figured I would stop it there because you're not going to hear it very often. You know, it's a rarity.
Right. There's a purple brush. Don and I have been together for 40 years. At some point in the 80s or 90s, there was a purple brush and I was right. I don't remember what it was about. I just remember, you know, I bring that up every once in a while. It's like, purple brush, that one moment. Remember when I was right that one time? You got to stop and savor.
I think that's true of any long-term relationship. You know, there's going to be something that you can bring up if you have to. you hold it in reserve because you don't want to bring it up if you don't have to. But on the other hand, you know.
On the other hand.
In context. So, so nuclear, because he works in nuclear, is super special, right? And he doesn't recognize anything in the rest of the world that is as special as what he does.
Well, right. You know, at the same time, he was kind of saying the opposite to part of at the end there, right? You know, the processes and so forth really aren't, you know, unique, right? They're the same as you get everywhere else. And as always, you know, I understand both points. The entire environment is bespoke. Now, you may have an electric motor in there. It's also used somewhere that isn't a nuclear power station, but you actually be kind of amazed. You know, nuclear power stations, the individual motors may not be used anywhere else either, right?
In some cases, not. But so you know, some cases they are. Some of the censors. But the other thing that just sort of strikes me about the whole approach is that the separation of safety from control is something that has existed in lots of places. Whenever you don't do that, it comes back to haunt you, right? Always.
Well, and let's have that debate. You know, I don't think we had that for the audience here, right? The air gap, right? You know, this air gap is what Joe and I have, you know, sparred about, you know, for many, many years. Because my point is, that's a great way to think about it, as long as you understand that they don't exist, right? You know, Information crosses every gap, you know, and there's no way
Let's talk about this, because the scientific result, which I've been waiting for a long time, which I think I've probably said it many times before, is black holes. So they claim no information goes in and out of black holes. But of course it does, because gravity. So it turns out, you know, the mass of a black hole changes as stuff goes in. So information is being, you know, extruded from the black hole just on its mass. And presumably, if you move mass within a black hole enough, you can change the dynamics around it and information is coming out. So yes, you're right in the general sense. And then there's this other, you know, in the electromagnetic world, whatever is happening on the other side of whatever the gap is you're trying to put in place, whatever the separation mechanism is, there, you know, atomic things move, electrons move, protons move, there are charges that move, and they have outside effects. And there is no way to completely eliminate that. The question really has to do with if you're going to try to communicate something intentionally, or if you're going to try and extract information that they don't know you're extracting or that they wish you didn't extract, or if you're trying to influence something inside, it's a matter of energy, how much power you have to put into it, and distance, because energy reduces as the, you know, the square of distance or the cube of distance, depending on the particulars. So at a distance with a sensor that's this good, you can hear that much of this thing, and at that resolution, you can get that much information out. And if you intentionally want to send the information out, then you can induce signals internally to produce those levels of content at a frequency, a set of frequencies such that you can get it out at some rate. There's some bit rate of transmission that you can get out. And of course, if you go from the digital into the analog space, then because analog variables are at some level of granularity continuous, you can get a whole lot of information out just by setting, you know, one parameter to one of the infinitesimal possibilities. So however many digits of accuracy and precision you have for transmission and reception dictates the amount of content you can get out per unit time. So all that being true, and I completely agree with that, doesn't justify connecting the internet to the thing that can blow up the bomb.
So Joe mentioned, you know, the, you know, IEC 62443, which is the International Electrotechnical Commission, I believe. But the IEC is the 100-year-old, you know, global industry standards for all sort of technical engineering things, electrotechnical things. Yeah. And 62443 is a great set of standards, and it talks a lot about this. It talks about zoning. You know, in zoning, you start at the conceptual level and say, all right, what are the important parts, you know, less, more, different, you know, what are the chunks? And as you look at actually architecting the information networks that will, you know, move information around, you know, you look at connecting those individual zones with conduits, you know, that have, you know, where you narrow it down, take a really hard look at what you want to do, what's appropriate. And from a, in a nuclear space, the most, the servos that pull the rods in and out of the nuclear core, you know, that critical zone, you know, to Fred and Joe's point, is not connected, you know, is physically separated air gap from, you know, the next, you know, the room outside it, the zone outside it. And as we go forward, you know, into this, you know, massively interconnected world and so forth, the idea of cryptographic zoning, you know, that you can make a virtual private network basically on top of another network and call that a separate zone.
Don't do it.
Right?
Well, so the problem with that, as has been demonstrated repeatedly, is that when you do that in this shared world we live in, right, the tragedy of the commons, the amount of bandwidth that you use at any given moment of time and the sequences of uses of that bandwidth produce information that allows you to see what's going on in the channel, and the ability to interfere with that because it's a shared space can also have effects on the communications that happens internally.
Well, but this is where consequence and priority comes down, because as you start to break down any industrial process into zones, you know, there's that bright red zone right there. And as Fred's saying, you know, we agree. It's like that actually is not, you know, those devices are wired together and there's lead lining the walls and whatever. But, you know, there's engineering zones and, you know, workforce support zones and so forth. You know, there's lots of different levels of consequence. And getting our minds around the idea that I would say, I hate to say it, but I don't mind being the peacemaker, because usually everybody's right by some definition. Right. And there are, you know, critical things need to be separated, some things physically and other things getting connected too.
Chris, there are people that are left.
There's some that are left. That's right. Some of them left the building. Elvis, I hear, has left the building.
That's what they say. But then there are rumors that he's still around. So the air gap, the separation thing is sort of fundamental, because when you talk about surety, there are not an unlimited number of levels of certainty, surety, with, you know, extents to which we can be certain that what we're doing will actually work. And when you talk about anything cryptographic, the cryptographic world is sort of in the medium surety level and good for medium consequences, right? But it's just, you know, history shows, you know, it's littered with the dead bodies of cryptographic systems that have been broken, right?
On so much security, and you know, this sort of thing as well. I love the, you know, the bamboo and the oak analogies and so forth, right? You know, you want to go to high pressure areas, you know, open all the doors, let the pressure go through, and you know, the consequence of someone knowing, as you're saying, watching the traffic of patterns, you know, they can't see whatever we're talking about. It's encrypted. It's a medium importance, you know, medium criticality zone, and they learn some things. But honestly, we don't check at the door. You know, you can just deliver a pizza to us and you can walk right in and with a camera on your head, take pictures. So it depends what you're trying to protect, how and how much. Until you get down to those important zones, and yes, then you call Joe up and you say, this thing right here, we want to engineer to the point that, you know, we can't even tell what it's doing.
Well, sometimes Joe will be able to do that and sometimes he won't, because as Joe will, I'm certain, tell you, well, it depends, right? So for this person over here working with this person, yeah, because there is a level of pickiness, right?
Yes.
And you know, if you don't which brings us, strangely enough, to the recent case of SolarWinds. SolarWinds is not a recent thing that happened. That's something from quite some time ago, except recently the government basically arrested or charged the CISO, Chief Information Security Officer of SolarWinds, with, I believe it's criminal fraud in their reporting of the situation with their cybersecurity in their company. And I'm reading through it, and I'm, you know, writing my December article on it because I think it's interesting enough. But this is a quote from the SEC filing, where apparently they say the CISO said, but I sort of thought SEC filings are signed off by the CEO, but they're blaming the CISO in this case. The current state of security leaves us in very vulnerable state for our critical assets. That's what it says. Okay, now, what the SEC is saying is, that's not adequate warning. Now, I'm sorry. How much warning do you want that we can be subject to cyber bad things than saying that the current state of security leaves us in a very vulnerable state for our critical assets? I mean, that's pretty bloody clear as warning, right?
You know, for transparency, I've known SolarWinds since its inception, you know, in the 90s, and I know the CISO in mentioned. And however, right, I think this is largely one of these big looming I told you so's, right? You know, and all around, where we've been saying for decades, look, there are existing laws on the books, enacted, enforced in real life, that say if you take other people's money and you're responsible for it, you have certain obligations to be diligent. As we're talking about in a previous segment, you know, those words, particularly legal words, really matter.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Mark climbs up the stack to influence and gets disgusted.
Joe gets sensitive about nuclear stuff and nearly implodes. Ron runs from footballs to cannonballs. ELN starts to accelerate. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string-beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.